The Music Business Worldwide podcast is supported by Volley Music, a leading financial management platform for the music industry. Volley enables you to track expenses, approve invoices, and make payments 24/7, 365 days a year. For your free trial, head to volleymusic.com. That's VOLYmusic.com.
Hello and welcome to the latest Music Business Worldwide podcast, supported once again by Volley Entertainment. Joining me on this podcast is Milana Rabkin-Lewis, the CEO and founder of Los Angeles-based STEM. STEM is a distribution and services company, including financial services, for independent artists. It's had a big year, not least last summer when it announced it had secured a $250 million credit agreement with Victory Park Capital, which has transformed the size and scope of artist advances STEM can offer. For a company that has grown used to seeing some of its biggest independent artists jump to major label deals, that $250 million raise is self-evidently something of a game changer for STEM and Milana. Long-term listeners to MBW's podcasts may remember that this isn't Milana's first time speaking to us. She last appeared on this very podcast 4 years ago, just at the tip of the pandemic, and she volunteered a number of predictions about the music business's years ahead, many of which have already come true, or at least partly come true. On this podcast, Milana and I discuss, with some agreement but not always, several crucial topics about the music business right now. From TikTok versus Universal to artist-centric streaming royalties, artificial intelligence, and much more besides. And of course, we discuss STEM and why Milana truly believes she is building a music company fit for the future. Milana Rabkin-Lewis, welcome to the Music Business Worldwide podcast. It's been a while since we spoke, I believe, on this podcast anyway, back in 2020. So just over 4 years ago. I've been keeping up with STEM, as I'm sure other people have, some raises that you've done. There was a very interesting deal you did last year. But give us the headlines. What's the most interesting things going on with STEM as we speak today?
Thanks, Tim, for having me back. I'm happy to be back and having this conversation with you. What is the most exciting stuff that's happening at STEM? I think it's just the consistent day-over-day growth and the type of artists we're getting to work with.
So when you say the type of artist, what do you mean? You mean in terms of the stature, in terms of the audience, in terms of their career trajectory? What do you refer to?
It's a little bit of everything, and that's what makes it exciting for us. A number of years ago, we became more curated as a platform, and that is something that we value as a business. And so when we sign new clients at this stage, it's because someone internally has a point of view. And when you have someone on a team that's incredibly passionate or has a point of view or is excited about an artist, the way that they move with that artist is entirely different. And that's what makes it exciting to watch my team engage with artists today. And because of that, we've had a number of great successes. So it's everything from identifying artists that are baby acts, never released music, that we get to put out for the first time and break into the world. We've had a lot of successes over the years with artists like that, dating back to early days of Giveon and Omar Apollo, to more recently artists like V's and Nicky Yor, who had a huge song last year called Sunrise. A number of them end up signing with the major, and that's okay. But it's still exciting to be the home that launches them. Even earlier on, dating back, that was people like Bad Bunny, and we were working with Big Loud when they first launched Morgan Wallen. So it's been fun to see that trajectory of some of those bigger artists as well. And then there's a lot of artists who had been with a major label and decided to become independent, and we get to be part of their strategy and becoming independent. So more recently, we spent a lot of time with a band called Laney. They were previously signed to one of the majors. I forget which record label under it, but they're an indie pop act. And now we can call them an indie pop act, but they've always been like an alt rock pop act. And they never found radio success with the major label. And most of the time, the reason why artists want to bring on a major label is because of their access to radio. They released last fall an album with us called A Beautiful Blur. And these guys, they're not new artists by any means. I mean, this is the second time that they've played the Forum and sold it out. So they're playing big rooms, in some cities, even arenas. So they're definitely at a good point in their careers. But it's unbelievable that like their songs, even though they have such like a rabid fan base, have never been on radio until we got XXL trending, and it's been on all top 40 radio stations across the country. And peaked at number one on the BDA-based charts. So that's when I say it's fun. Like, to me, it's feeling like we're making impossible things possible. And that's a mantra that I live by.
Wow. Well, I'm interested to know that there's just a couple of, speaking of headlines, there's a couple that I've been looking back on Music Business Worldwide and elsewhere about STEM in recent years. There was a major announcement last summer where you reached a deal with Victory Park Capital, and that was all to do with the level of artist advance that you could offer. And then there was a raise, I don't know if it was a year before that, a couple of years before that, but this is when Block got involved in the business, which I found really interesting at the time because we'd talked a lot about the kind of financial services side that you could offer artists. So I'm interested in how the company has evolved in terms of what it can offer artists, particularly from the Victory Park agreement, but also from Block's involvement in the company and other investors.
Definitely. The Victory Park relationship is a really powerful one that we're just really, truly getting started with. They are a fund that's based in Chicago, and their primary business is providing capital to other businesses that have a unique model where they lend against what the people call alternative assets. Music in the finance world is looked at as an alternative asset class that's uncorrelated to the economy, which means that if the economy isn't performing, which in the last year it had not been, we're not in the best economic state as a world, not just the country. The stock markets have plummeted in many ways, and yet music still performs really well. It's uncorrelated to the economy, and people like that. And it's also a really interesting annuity in that it kicks off cash flows relatively in perpetuity. And so for us, our biggest challenge has been that in order for us to keep growing the artists that we launch or invest in the artists that we're bringing on that are coming off a major label, is the ability for us to fund them. And we did our first deal with another fund called CoVenture, which we had an incredible relationship with. But that fund is thought of as a starter fund in that we had a lot of constraints on what kind of a check size we could write and how quickly that money had to pay back. So that was really us being able to advance revenue that we would estimate would pay back within 2 to 3 years. With Victory Park, that amount doubles, if not triples. So it's us being able to extend larger check sizes, slightly more patient capital. And just, we learned a lot through the first fund that we applied into this fund to be able to deploy more money against not just catalog of artists, but also be able to release against future advances, which is something that not many other people other than major labels or businesses with their own balance sheet are able to do.
I'm just interested briefly on Block's involvement in the business. If that's changed anything, I mean, maybe they just put investment in and letting you get on with it, which is absolutely fine and dandy. But I just found it interesting how STEM for a long time, I'm sure continues to partly differentiated itself on the financial services and financial education it could offer artists. And I thought that was a very synergistic coupling when I saw Block and yourselves come together.
Definitely. So there's another thing we actually did in the last year, which we haven't talked about yet, which is we clarified our businesses. So we launched a new brand called Tone, and it really is its own business unit within STEM with its own dedicated team, its own engineering team, product, operations, sales, marketing, et cetera. And what Tone is, it's all of the software that we've built initially for STEM to do the split payments, the recoupment, the visualizations of the data, and built it in a way that other labels that we do not distribute can use. So under the STEM company brand, we have STEM Distribution, which is, I think, what most people are familiar with us for. And then we launched a separate brand called Tone, which is pretty much just software. It has royalty services. So a label needs us to do their royalty calculations in the same way that they would hire an accountant or an outside firm to do. We can do it full service, but what they really get as well is this technically elegant dashboard experience and not only managing the whole workflow around royalties, so everything from expenses to contract management all the way through not just calculations, but the third piece, which is setting up the payments in an automated way, providing the data and reporting in the dashboard, not just to the label that's doing the accounting, but more importantly, to everyone who's getting paid. And we're going to continue to extend and evolve various feature sets from there that we're really excited about. We can talk about that too. But the clarification of the business came from realizing that it's really hard to tell our story. People have a separate understanding of what a distribution company does, and people have a totally separate understanding of what royalty accounting does. And oftentimes within an organization, it's different people who are making decisions about who they're partnering with on each side. And so we decided to clarify that story by being able to say, hey, when you need distribution, you talk to STEM. When you need something resolving payments or royalty accounting or data visualization, that's tone for you. And more importantly, you can use tone even though you're not a STEM customer. And I can talk about why that's really important as well. And our relationship with Block and the way that's connected is really learning from their business, Jesse DeRogaster, who's now leading title under Block as well. And he was running product for all of Block prior to that, is on our board as an observer. And he's part of a lot of the conversations. There's a lot of things that we're learning from how Block launched when it was launching its first product, Square, and how it's evolved since then. And vice versa, I think they're learning a lot about the music industry from us as well. So it's a pretty symbiotic relationship at this point. I can't say that we're doing any integrations or anything strategic beyond that. But really, for me, taking the investment from Block was accelerating our knowledge and our learning curve around what it's like to build real financial solutions for business owners.
Great. I was looking back over the podcast that we did in 2020, and we did talk a bit about STEM as we have here, but we talked a lot about a number of industry issues, and you had some views on those issues, and most of those views have, if not completely come true, then seems to be on the way to do. I guess the first thing to talk about really is the obvious one and a nice bridge into a wider conversation about the industry, which is an independent artist, how empowered they can be to continue their career independently the moment that a major record company comes in to sign them, as we talked about before. Is that changing? Are they offering less money? But very importantly, behind the scenes, are you noticing the deal terms change? Because it used to be very obvious. It used to be a binary conversation almost when we talked about an independent artist signing with a distributor or a services company and then signing a major record deal. We have these very high profile examples, Taylor Swift being an obvious one, whereby we don't know the full details of the deal, but it certainly looks like there's some sort of distribution services elements to it and certainly a high margin for the artist. Are you noticing anything over the last, I guess, 4 years since we spoke in terms of the differences of the deals that you're offering versus when the majors inevitably come in for your most popular artists or try to come in? And also whether or not those artists always go to the majors?
Yeah, I'll say this. I don't know if anyone actually values being independent. And I know that's like pretty crazy for someone like me to say. And the reason I say that is because I think there's a big difference between independence and autonomy. And I think people conflate the two. I think when artists say they want to be independent, what they really mean is they want to be autonomous. And at different stages of their careers, the value in that is going to change. I think if you're an emerging artist, there's very few of them who actually truly want to do it independently, because what they really want is access to capital, investment, and a team that really cares about them to be able to get them off the ground. And I think they're willing to trade ownership over a certain extent in order to get that. Now, what I think is changing is like they're not willing to sign everything away forever. And I think that the major labels are realizing that and adapting as well, but they're willing to sign the first few projects that they come up with. And they're willing to give the rights away to those projects for a very long time as well, because it warrants a bigger advance and it warrants a bigger investment. So what we're seeing, what's interesting, is the market's moving pretty aggressively. When we started STEM, a lot of the major labels were not making huge investments in artists. And I think that's what really sparked a lot of growth in the independent sector. They were doing pretty conservative deals because that was coming out of a pretty terrible market for the music industry, and that streaming hadn't fully become globalized. So there wasn't as much recorded revenue coming in. And just as an example, when we started the race for the Victory Park Fund, what we saw in the market was a lot of major labels were underwriting deals, even for new artists, to pay back and call it 5 to 8 years and maybe 10. And what we're seeing now is they're underwriting deals to pay back in 15, maybe even 20. And that in 20 years is, correct me if I'm wrong, Tim, but that's pretty much like life of copyright, isn't it?
Well, yeah, depends on the territory and the era. But yes, I see your point. So what does that mean for a company like STEM and the opportunities that lie in front of you?
It means we have to be more aggressive. We have to be able to underwrite our capabilities or accept the fact that those types of artists who are just shopping for the largest check size are not the right fit for us. And that's okay. The good news is that there's enough out there. The other thing I'll add is that on the other side of the spectrum, for more established artists, major record labels are just looking like distributors. It's, you look at the deal that Republic just did with Big Loud. Big Loud is a client of ours for close to a decade, really. And we started working with them when they were a bubbling label. Like they were doing single digit millions in revenues, and they grew on our platform to who they are today, which is a tremendously large player in the country space. And we're really proud of the growth that we had with them. But ultimately, they decided that for their next phase, they really wanted to be part of a major record label ecosystem. And that's something we can't compete with at this stage. And they signed truly just a distribution deal. And they marketed in the press as a distribution deal. That's probably the same type of deal that someone like a Drake or a Taylor Swift or a Bad Bunny or a BTS is on, right? Hybe just announced yesterday they renewed their deal with Universal. That probably looks like a very low single digit distribution deal, if I had to assume. And I think what's interesting now is that the major labels are also becoming more diversified in the type of deals that they're structuring. And I think it's conflating what people's perception of the independent market is. It's really hard to size it because there's a lot of these bigger players that are providing market share to the major record label companies, and they're taking very low fees for being able to retain those clients and attract them. And they're making that trade because they know that maybe they're trading near-term revenue for long-term enterprise value. I think it's a very smart trade and it makes a lot of sense. And I think they're doing deals on everything in between. So the notion of the value proposition of being with an independent distributor when you can get the same type of economics within a major label is making it more competitive.
I don't want to make the discussion too nebulous. So I will direct us away from this after I've asked this, but everything that you're talking about makes me think about this stat that Spotify put out the other week. And I know they did it on their Loud and Clear site the other day. They paid out $9 billion-ish, I think they said, to recorded and publishing last year. And they say around half of that $4.5 billion was independence. But actually, if you scratch beneath the surface, and I should have written this article rather than saying it out loud, but I guess I will at some point. But actually, when I speak to Spotify, that number is effectively, it's every artist who isn't signed to a major record company. So they could be signed to an indie that goes through a major distributor. They could be signed to an independent label. They could be signed as an independent artist to a DIY service or anything in between. But so long as they're not on a major record label. And then you think like that, that includes the likes of Bad Bunny. And it's reported or believed that Sony now own like a third of a part of Rimas and they've invested in it. So there's question marks over that. But then we go back to the points that you were making, be it Hybe or the one that I said, Taylor Swift. We don't fully know all the details of those deals aren't exposed. But if we saw them, we'd ask the question, what is independence? Is it owning your copyrights? Is it owning them for now? Is it getting them back in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years? And what does it mean versus autonomy? And I just think the point that you're making, the impossibility, if you like, of sizing the independent market is really, really interesting, because the only thing that anyone seems to be able to define is a major label. But actually, we don't know what's in those deals.
And also, they don't really have independence either. Meaning the people you just named, they signed to the independent distribution arm. Yes, they own their catalog. They're not selling their catalog per se, but they can't make decisions the way that most independent artists move. Even using the Universal recent example with TikTok, their music got taken down. It's not their choice. Someone else made that decision for them.
I mean, you've brought it up. So I have other things to ask you about, but I've got to ask you about that because my fingers are tired and withered from writing those words Universal and TikTok so much this year. What's your take on it? And especially seeing as where we are now when we speak, this is late March 2024. Many people, probably myself included, thought, well, this is going to get ugly around the time that the threat of Universal's publishing coming down. So I think that was the start. Gosh, time moves quickly. I can't remember if it was the end of February or start of March, I think. And I thought, well, it'll get done before then because it's got really messy and ugly and we don't see many closer to it happening. So when I say the words TikTok Universal, what do you immediately think of?
Oh my God. Does TikTok care? I have no insight into the underpinnings of the conversation, where they stand. But if I were TikTok, I wouldn't give a shit. I just wouldn't.
Well, there are some stats that show that user engagement is down. Now, how much of that can be attributed to Universal's catalog moving off the platform. I don't know if they've said this publicly, but it's fair to say they're doing everything they can to pump energy and attractiveness into rival services, like Reels being an obvious example, YouTube Shorts being another. So I think that TikTok's probably feeling the heat from those services more now that Universal is able to give them an advantage. I understand where you're coming from. I guess the bigger question that you're raising is what we would consider blockbuster or premium music or the top 10,000 tracks in the world, do they really matter to TikTok at the end of the day when it can go back and pick a catalog track that barely anyone's listened to for 30 years and make it the trending track on the platform? It's an interesting debate. Personally, I would say that TikTok probably do care. As time goes on and users find that they cannot access the catalog that they instantaneously want to access, we've mentioned her a few times, or at least I have, Taylor Swift being an obvious example. I think eventually that becomes a frustration for the users. And I think eventually that shows up in user engagement numbers.
Possibly, but a lot of that music's finding its way back on TikTok.
That's a whole other debate. But yes, you're right. It is. We're sped up, slowed down.
No, like a lot of those labels and managers have called us and probably a lot of other distributors to say, can you release my music on TikTok for me? I'm taking it down from Universal. If they have the option to do that. And some of them are just bypassing it entirely and saying, we'll ask for forgiveness and not permission. And in other cases, like in the press yesterday, Scooter announced that they're doing a direct deal with TikTok. So even though they just negotiated their deal with Universal, they're going direct to TikTok. So my point is TikTok knows this is going to happen. Yes, it's going to put pressure on them that Reels is going to get the beneficial content. Sure. But what I can't get over in my mind is that hasn't the music business learned their lesson yet? I mean, one of my favorite books to recommend to people about the music industry is Steve Knopper's book, which is like The Appetite for Self-Destruction. And it talks about how with every new format change, the music business tries to do this, resist it, ends up shooting itself in the face, and then being the loser in the whole situation and like losing out on something, and eventually adopting it and like figuring out how to work with it.
I'm not sure I 100% agree with you, but I am going to put a time limitation on what we talk about. And I want to talk about things that you got right in the past. So maybe in 4 years' time, I'll be apologizing and saying you got that spot on. But 4 years ago, one of the things you mentioned, which I cannot bring up, I think these are my words, I'm completely paraphrasing here, but was the vulnerability of financial players who were paying certain multiples for certain rights in a comfortable macroeconomic environment. And you were calling into question whether or not that was going to hit the skids or hit a difficult period. And indeed, interest rates started to rise. And that kind of played out 4 years on, looking back, other than saying, I told you so, what else can you observe about what's happened to these outside financial players who got excited really about a frothy music market and paid, as I said, particular multiples for particular rights?
I am grateful for the excitement in music as an asset class. It's one of the reasons we were able to raise a second fund through a partner like Victory Park, is because of how excited the hypnosises of the world got the music industry. What I was afraid of at the time and what played out was that they would put a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths about recorded music and the music industry itself. And I think that's really scary still. It is harder to raise against music assets than it was at the time. The other thing they did is they created an incredibly competitive environment for underwriting deals. Now, some of their underwriting is tremendously more aggressive, but it up-leveled what everyone else had to do to compete. But the difference is a lot of these other players, like the major record labels, they're using balance sheet cash. They have no cost of capital. They don't care what the interest rate is. And I think it was what also pushed them towards being able to get more aggressive across the board, not just on catalog, but on new deals as well. And I think that's candidly made it harder for independents to compete.
I can see how that's true. At the same time, another thing that you mentioned 4 years ago, I'm going to keep referencing some of the comments that were made. You were talking about how you expected A&R spend for majors to potentially go down as they became publicly traded companies. Now, I would argue that probably hasn't happened. However, and you can tell me your view, you'll be closer to the market, obviously. But what has happened, and let's just take Universal as an example, they have stopped spending or significantly lessened the balance sheet cash that they're spending on catalog rights acquisitions. And indeed, just the other week, they announced side fund with a third party called Music that on their earnings call, I don't know what it was, let's say at the top of March, I think it was Boyd Muir, the CFO, was saying effectively, we're going to use just that. We're just going to use that Chord Music vehicle now to acquire catalogs. And we're not going to use our own balance sheet. So investors don't have to worry that this is going to negatively affect dividends, which is effectively where that I think that ends up. What's your take on that? So what I'm saying is you made a prediction. And from what I can see, you got it half right, because actually it wasn't the frontline, I don't think, A&R spend. And again, please tell me if I'm wrong there. It was this catalog acquisition drive that they've had to move out from their own balance sheet.
Yeah. And the other thing you didn't bring up is the fact that they had massive layoffs and are restructuring their whole entire company to change the way that they invest in resource against artists as well. They're becoming more streamlined. And that's, I think, going to create candidly, that actually, I think, benefits the independents even more. I can't comment too much on the Chord situation and why they're deciding to use balance sheet capital. I think you probably nailed it by saying that it impacts investors' interests because it doesn't come out of dividends. I think that's probably right to some extent. I think that they are spending less on A&R. And to your earlier question about distribution, like they're resourcing more like a distribution company would. And I think because the majority of their artists prefer those type of deals, I think they want a large check size and they want some level of services in-house. But I think what that speaks to also is the fact that a lot of managers are the ones doing the A&Rs these days. And what the managers need might be different in terms of resourcing and how you resource against those types of people than you would just a regular artist, because managers already have some resources in-house.
And this may speak to, all right, if the A&R spend overall has potentially declined, flatlined, whatever we want to say, what's definitely happened is, and if you just look at Universal as an example, as a priority investment, Virgin Music Group has effectively become, from, there's an argument that you could say it's now one of its three priority frontline label groups alongside that now Interscope Group and the Republic Core hub thing on the East Coast. Virgin Music Group is a global priority for Universal because it knows, I presume, that it needs to meet those artists in the middle, those artists that don't need the full major label service. It needs to meet them in the middle. Are you seeing that the majors are increasing investment in that area? I'm guessing an area that would touch on your business more than the others.
Absolutely. I mean, it's in everyone's annual letter in the beginning of the year. You look at what Robert Kinsel wrote about in his letter about Warner and their aggressive moves towards trying to make a bid towards Believe. You look at Thomas Cofield and his letter about BMG and them straightening, really prioritizing, strengthening the universe, sorry, not the universal, the US, North America presence of BMG and their distribution services and their payment services. I love the fact that people are recognizing the value of what type of offering we've created and are trying to replicate it. And I think that's great because at the end of the day, like, the market's big enough. And I think that the more options there are for artists, the more that they can actually be autonomous and they can pick the best partner. And I think competition's good. Am I thrilled about it? I mean, listen, I feel like every single day I'm fighting tooth and nail with my team to sign the best artist and work with the team and keep the artist that we have. And we're candidly in that fight with a water gun and everyone else has an AK-47 because their balance sheet is much bigger than mine. But that's a problem that's going for me to try to change. Like, how do I armor up better?
I think the Victory Park deal has given you like a super soaker or a Nerf gun. You know, it's a bit more than a water pistol these days.
I think exactly. We now have a super soaker. We used to have that little dinky 99 cent water gun. We have a super soaker now. I'd really love to have more ammo. And what's amazing to me, and this is what's amazing to me about my team, and when you asked me earlier, the reason I answered the question about watching my team move is because we still win. There's moments in which we are at that fight with a super soaker and they have an AK-47 or whatever the most powerful gun is. I don't love guns, just to be clear. And we still win. And that amazes me. And I think that also speaks to the offering that we have.
You brought it up. I wasn't going to mention this. Let's see if you have any observations on it. A world in which, and we will see if they even put a bid in, because as we speak, I think they've got 12 days left to do. But imagine a world in which Warner does challenge the Denis Ladegallery bid for Believe and actually ends up taking over Believe. Is that a good thing, terrible thing, somewhere in the middle for the global music market and for the independent sector?
I've been thinking a lot about this. Do I think it's a good or bad thing? I think the Believe part of it is net neutral because a lot of those artists, I think, would be comfortable working within a major label ecosystem. I think that with TuneCore, the brand messaging about TuneCore and a lot of people on that platform pride themselves on being fiercely independent, I wonder how they're going to react. I candidly also think that if Warner wanted to boost up ADA, I don't know if I were in their shoes, if I would go after Believe. It just feels like a step backwards and not a step forwards in the future.
Why would you say a step backwards? I've got lots of questions. Again, I'm going to refuse to allow us to get stuck on this, but I'll try and get some of them out. Why would Believe be a step backwards? I'm interested, for example, I'm going to present company excluded because that would be an unfair thing. There's companies like Downtown and 1RPM that people don't speak about very often that has this amazing market share in Brazil and is expanding internationally. There are other things that could be looked at other than Believe, but I guess Believe comes with such scale and investment in a lot of territories early, to Denis' great credit, investment in a lot of Asian territories in particular, that the majors are behind on. I'm interested on why you think it may be argued to be a backward step.
So I'm thinking about it more from a technical and product experience point of view, but you're right. They have an incredible presence in emerging markets, and I think that's really attractive. You're right. I love the senior leadership at TuneCore. I spend a lot of time with them over the years. Like, Andrea and I have spent quite a bit of time just getting to know each other, but also when we decided to divest some of our long tail users, we partnered with TuneCore for a very specific reason because we thought they had a great offering and we trusted that team to take care of our clients. The reason why I say that is because they're not the most technically forward business. They developed a lot of their technology probably around the same time ADA built theirs, candidly. In terms of what I think Robert's trying to accomplish, and Max and the whole leadership team there, and I haven't spent too much time with them, but have had conversations. And obviously, there's a lot of stuff they're writing and posting, so there's a lot to acquire there, too. I think that there's a lot of cleanup within even looking at Believe and TuneCore and turning it into what they want it to be. It's a beast, so they're acquiring a lot of revenue, which is great. They're acquiring a lot of market share in terms of penetration in new markets, but like relatively speaking, the majority of, I can't speak to Believe, but TuneCore's business is content that doesn't actually generate a lot of streams. It's content that people pay to get up there. I call it the business of selling dreams versus the music business, because a lot of the client base are parents who pay the subscription or the fee to keep their kids' music up on Spotify and Apple because it's nostalgic, right? Like it means something to them, not because it's really making money.
The stats are out now. I mean, thanks to Luminate, I used to guess at these things using Loud and Clear stats, but we know that whatever it is, around a quarter of music has zero plays every year. And we're talking a quarter of wherever, somewhere between 100 and 200 million now. And we've also seen Deezer basically kick back 26 million tracks to the distributors, which I want to talk to you about in a second, artist-centric, that whole thing. But just because, like, I'm speaking to the world expert on this subject, you made reference to it yourself, I can see precisely why Believe might be attractive to Warner. And the TuneCore piece is where I have a question mark, because Warner's dabbled in this with Level Music. It didn't seem to really want to do it. Universal pulled out of it with Spin Up, like in a similar time frame, I believe, that Stem made that decision. And I think it just seemed to me like all of the sort of most forward players in the market, some of the largest players in the market, came to the same conclusion, which is that this is a very low margin business that takes up a lot of resource. And to your point, like the dream that it leads to an artist moving a step up, then another step up, then another step up, and lo and behold, we have the next Taylor Swift, never really came to pass. So I'm just, if you were running Warner, TuneCore, having that, so just in case those listening don't know, I think it was 2019, I did a bit of research before we spoke, but Stem, to, as Milana pointed out, backed away or moved away from a kind of everyone can upload what they want DIY model to a more selective, as she talks about at the top of the podcast, a more selective model where Stem signs the artist that it believes it can help further their career, and there's good business for both the artist and for Stem involved. But Stem moved away from DIY. There was a lot of controversy. A lot of artists were worried and what have you. And now that sector is dominated by the likes of DistroKid and TuneCore. And if I were a major label head, I'm not sure it would be the most attractive business to be in.
That's what I said, I think that there's a number of very established artists on that platform. There's definitely labels that we meet all the time that are still using it because it's a better cost-effective option for them. And they choose to do that. There's a lot of great catalog parked at TuneCore. Don't get me wrong. And yes, every so often there's a Dominic Fike that launches off a TuneCore or a distro. But I do think it's a different business. And I do believe that what you said is that the chances of that leading to the discovery of the next big artist and that giving that company, whether it's Warner, whoever else ends up, that's a major, an advantage because it started on that platform, the amount of effort it would take to pay attention and then be able to retain at that moment when you don't have a contractual agreement would be nearly impossible. I deal with it every day. We launch those artists, and because we don't have them in a contract, we lose them and they get outbid. So it's like, even though they might be in-house, how much earlier are you really going to notice it than anyone else?
I'm sure there's a flip side to that where your team are probably discovering artists who are on TuneCore or DistroKid or whatever and putting their phone calls in, and the same goes. There is no deep ties to those platforms. It's just the way it is, and you could bring them over.
I think cost outweighs the benefit, to your point.
And as I said, you would be the expert because you've lived and breathed it. But the other bit that I was trying to bring in before and then decided to pause for a second was this Deezer scenario. So there's two parts to this. Number one, Deezer kicking back or cutting 26 million, I think it was 26 million, around 25 million tracks from its service, a lot of which is what it deems noise. But other people, before we were having this conversation, I was doing some writing. I was listening to Focus Music on Spotify. It was very useful. I put a value in it. There's a lot of debate around that. Other things that Deezer have cut are quote unquote fake artists. And as the person who runs a publication who arguably coined that term, like I see the debate around what is a fake artist and who should decide that that is a label to be put on something. And then we eventually end up at the final stop, which is artist-centric, as it's been called, the model that Universal is at least partially designed and is experimenting with a couple of platforms, Spotify being one, making its moves. Artists have to have 1,000 streams a year to earn any money, etc. And Deezer making its moves, which has actually ended in this quite drastic cut of 25, 26 million tracks. So just to get your view, and this is my guess, artist-centric, if you like, is probably net positive for STEM because you do handpick artists, you do work with professional or professionally aspiring, as Spotify calls them, artists. So to the benefit of those artists. But at the same time, I guess there's a debate to be had over the kind of arguably arbitrary categorization of an artist not being worthy of monetization or not being worthy of being on a platform. So I just would guess that your perspective is an interesting one.
I just had a 2-hour conversation with an artist of ours who I've become friends with, Justin Blau, who's also a tech founder, about this. And I want to give you his perspective. And then you should have him on this podcast to talk about it because it's fascinating. But before I share what we talked about, I think it is net positive. The reason why we chose to be curated is because we realized that everyone else is delivering a shit ton of content every single week. And when it comes to trying to advocate for your artists, like I have so many friends that are editors, they come to my house and like sometimes we'll all work together and I'll watch how they edit. And it's crazy to me. There's a dashboard back and they're looking through with all of the releases and they're organized alphabetically. So if like you're an artist with a name that's later, like by the time they start editing and finish, like they're never getting to your name. It's crazy to me. And there's a whole process of like, yes, some of it's algorithmic, some of it, like there's emails I get sent out in order to highlight certain artists that are priorities and pitches and all that crap to surface stuff, which is fine, but it's wildly inefficient because of how much volume there is. Versus when we deliver stuff at STEM and they look at what we've delivered, it's a short list. We stand out. So if we deliver something, it stands out. And I think that we're going to start seeing is there's going to be different types of, call it music storefronts that are going to emerge, that are going to be homes for more sounds and call it longer tail content. And I think what would be great is if like the Apples and the Spotifys and the Deezers of the world and the Tidals of the world are preserved for more human artists. Now, then the question becomes about AI music, which I don't want to go too far into because I don't have that much of a formed opinion around it. But it does bring the question, which Justin asked me, which is why should music be valued? Why should music be worth anything? Why should people pay for music? And my like instinct reaction to that was like, of course they have to pay for it. It's valuable. There's cultural value to it. And he's like, but why is it worth paying someone's time to make? Is it only worth something because someone spent time doing it? So what happens if you diminish that time to zero?
I would say that you're paying for the mental and emotional benefits. You're paying for very often the clarity that music will bring to you. You're paying to be moved. And if music doesn't do any of those things, or it does something more pedestrian, like shuts out noise and helps you focus, then there is definitely a value in that. I take his point. I guess you end up at the argument that not all music is valued the same. And you have to try and make the value difference clear somehow. I used the word arbitrary before, but you have to do it somehow. And base popularity is not a terrible place to start, I guess. I think there's a lot of it. You came up with a great phrase earlier, but the sort of harvesting of dreams of amateur artists. A lot of these kids think once their music's on Spotify, hey, there's me next to Linkin Park or Jay-Z or whoever. And it's like, no, you're not in the Tower record store next to their CD. That's not what's happened. Like, you've just burnt a CDR and put it in your cupboard. Their CDs are over in Tower Records. There's different, that Spotify is a world. It's not a store. And I do think it's probably healthy that music, to your friend Justin's point, but music that doesn't have a clear apparent value doesn't deserve to take up space for music that does. I guess that would be my roundabout perspective, but you asked a tricky question, so sorry if I gave a tricky answer.
Well, and to your point, not only there's another problem, there's a cost to it. There's a cost to maintaining that amount of music, to managing it, to curating it, to having to invent all these different ways to be able to surface editorially appropriate music, let's call it, from everything else. And that's expensive. That takes up a lot of the cost on the side of the DSPs to manage that, which takes things out of the profit margin, which is ultimately one of the reasons why they need to be able to take a higher cut of the songs that are on that platform for providing that platform. That's the cost of providing the platform. And I think that if you clean that up, there's better economics for everyone. So I'm very much in favor of the artist-centric model. I'm very much in favor of separating the different type of music and assigning a different value for the type of music, depending on what its value is. I think it's really tough to define what value is. And Tim, I love the attempt that you tried to even put words to it because it's hard. It's really tricky. But I'll leave you with this because you said something that I thought was really interesting, which is that in talking about the artists that are aspiring, for them, it means something to be sitting alongside the Linkin Parks or whoever that they admire. And I want to ask the question of, do you think that matters in the future? Because I had one of the most insane conversations with a 10-year-old that terrified me. And my nephew's 10. He's an aspiring musician. He's a cute little redhead that's in the School of Rock band. He looks like a mini Ed Sheeran. He's been practicing his craft and he performs now with the band at 10 years old, which is like the cutest thing in the world. They just played the Whiskey Ago a couple of weeks ago. But I had this conversation with him where I invited him to Coachella a year ago. And he's like, I don't really want to go. And I was like, why? And he's, I don't really want to see bands perform. So I left it there. I just thought he was moody. And then a couple months later, I invited him to a very special show that Ed Sheeran and John Mayer did together. And he's a guitarist and looks like a little mini Ed Sheeran. And I was like, you got to go see Ed. You got to go see John. These guys are like the best living guitarists today. And he's like, I don't care. I don't want to see the artists perform their music. I want to perform the music the way that I believe it should be performed. And there's a theory out there among the tech community too that I've heard, which is that in the future, people will not care to listen to music from people they do not know. It'll become hyper local again.
I'm not sure I buy it. I see where you're coming from and I appreciate the personal anecdote, but Spotify recently pinched an analogy of mine. I don't lay claim to a lot. I'll lay claim to fake artists and I'll lay claim to this analogy, which was about footballers or soccer players and how many of them are even borderline professional level in the world versus the amount of people that play for fun. And then, of course, the top earning megastars, the Messis and Ronaldos and what have you, the Haalands. And I feel as a kid, of course, you want to participate in football. But at the same time, like eventually you're going to get to go to Wembley or whichever pick your international stadium. And you're going to see the best of the best, like the best of the best. And it's not just about he or she can do that and I cannot. It's about you are participating. Like you're part of the crowd. That is participation. And no, you don't get to fold your arms and say, I'm not interested unless I get to run out and play with them. I don't think that's just like a generational difference. I feel like that's a realization that's going to have to hit a generation. Or maybe we're just waiting for that realization to come. Or maybe football stadiums are going to be empty in 50 years and everyone will be laughing at me. I completely understand that everyone wants to participate now and splice up and speed up and modify and put their own voice on top of something. I get it. And I get how that's going to be a big market in the future, especially as tools come along to make it easier. But I still don't believe that that negates people stood in a stadium or an arena watching Adele and their heart racing. Like I just can't conjoin the two. I think they're two different things.
I hope you're right. That would be devastating to me, that version of the future. And I have to check my reaction when I hear things like this, because I still remember my early reactions to having conversations with other people around. And they're not just regular people. Like I had this crazy conversation with, do you know who this guy Joshua Harris is?
I do not. Educate me.
So Joshua Harris was a very early tech entrepreneur in the early 90s who created the first company that live streamed live video on the internet back in the broadband days, which was like very... And there's a great documentary on him by this director, Andy Tinnamore, which highly recommend anyone who listens to this podcast watch. It's called We Live in Public. And he pretty much predicted the influencer culture of today back in the 90s. And the documentary is fascinating because it covers him over the course of 10 years, self-mediating himself and watching not only him, but the societies that he's created. Because he created these many societies where you could opt in to live in the society and everything was free. But the only exchange was that you gave up your privacy, everything you did all day, every day in every room, whether it's going to the bathroom or sleeping with your partner at night, was documented and live streamed on the internet. When I had a conversation with him in 2011, or when I was early days starting my job at UTA, and he said to me, he's in the future, kids are going to broadcast themselves brushing teeth and it'll be sponsored by Colgate. And people are going to be watching other people pick out outfits, get dressed, and they will be paid for that. And the clothes will be free. And I was like, you're insane. Why would anyone want to do that? And he's like, and it's going to take away people's attention spans from wanting to see television and pay for movies and go to theaters. And people are going to become more isolated and disconnected from each other. And I was like, you're crazy. That's never going to happen.
At the end of his prediction, did he say, and then the horsemen will come? and then the skies will go black. I mean, it is scary when you put it like that. But again, I have to maintain a belief that the emotional power of music will prevail, but we'll see.
I pray right, and I hope you're right. But every time I have that type of reaction now, I have to check myself. And then I have to ask all the questions that are like, well, what if this is true? What does that mean? And that's the way I'm trained to think at this point, because if your job is to present, if you're building for the future of something, which is what I think my job is, to build for the future of the music industry, not for the past, I have to continually ask myself, but what if this is true? What needs to happen in order for that to be true? And what are the things that I could personally do to preserve the integrity of the industry that I value?
Well, I'm sure everybody listening to this will be interested to see how you get on that mission in the years ahead. I have faith. Milana Rabkin-Lewis, thank you very much for joining us on the Music Business Worldwide podcast.
Thank you, Tim, for having me. Fun conversation, like always.